Welcome to Filmstrip. These podcasts are spoiler-filled as we discuss the plots, characters, and themes of the films in review. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.
Welcome to Filmstrip. I'm Jay.
I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Ron.
And for summer vacation, get in the car. We're going to Nilbog, fam. That's right. It's time to talk about Troll 2, starring, and I mean in the loosest sense of that term ever used on this show, Michael Stevenson, George Hardy, Connie McFarlane, Jason Wright, Margot Prey, Deborah Reed, and Robert Ormsby. Written by Rosella Druidy and Claudio Fragasso, directed by Claudio Fragasso under the pseudonym Drake Floyd. Allegedly had a $100,000 to $200,000 budget. We're going to talk about that. Yeah, when it was released in 1990. So watch Troll 2, you may wonder. Well, like I said, it's summer vacation time here, and this one has lived on the Filmstrip list to do for like over a decade. Like, it has been out there for a while, and we finally, like, we're doing it this summer. It's got to happen. And Lindsay, I want to start with you. Is this your first exposure to the Troll 2?
It's not, Jay.
Oh, awesome.
My first exposure to Troll 2 was, I think, 1995. So
wow.
A few years after it came out. I was in, I want to say, fifth, sixth grade. And my cousins and I stayed with them for the summer. And our grandmother would take us to the Yellow Front grocery store, movie store thing,
yes,
that was like attached to it.
The combo, yes.
Yep. And we would just go through every single horror movie on the shelf, and she led us, and eventually we made our way to Troll 2, and we giggled through the entire movie. And while I was watching it, rewatching it again for this, I sent my cousin Krista a text, and I was like, dude, do you remember watching Troll 2 when we were kids? And she goes, oh my God, that was amazing. Yes, of course. So I was exposed to it not terribly long after it was released. So
that is awesome. I did not have that on my bingo card. So what about you? When did you find Troll 2?
Well, I definitely don't have that level of backstory with Troll 2. But I found it sometime in the 2010s, about the time it started to gain traction as like a famously bad movie. But man, whew, what a winner. I wish I'd discovered it back in the 90s, because wow, that I went so long without this in my life is very sad.
Yeah. I didn't get this one until like the late aughts. I think people talking about it too. And the reason I was laughing, Lindsay, not that you were in the fifth grade doing this, is I was in college in 1995. So this is the portion of the show, once again, where Lindsay reminds everybody how fucking old I am.
So it always feels old when it's like within that earlier decade of your life.
I mean, it does. But I got this one in the late aughts, I guess I'd say, or whatever, because I heard people talking about it, and I was like, I have to see this. And I did, and I thought, oh wow, what a feast. And I've never done the other thing, though. I never went back, because I know it has nothing to do with Troll 1. It's just one of those we're slapping the name on it things. I've never watched Troll 1, though. It's on Tubi. I should give it a spin. Have either of you ever seen Troll 1?
Oh yeah, I had myself a nice little troll fest that weekend. So this is a couple weekends ago. I watched Troll 1, Troll 2, and the best worst movie. Like all in the same.
So you got the documentary in too.
Yes, 10 stars, would recommend.
Wow.
All three.
That is amazing. I haven't seen Troll. Ron, have you seen Troll 1?
I saw Troll 1 about the time I saw Troll 2 for the first time, but it's literally been 15 years, so I honestly don't remember anything about it. I just remember it being a pretty solid, like, Ghoulies ripoff, if that tells you anything.
Yeah, what's the quick synopsis of Troll 1, Lindsay, for anybody? We'll get a little bonus review here on the show.
It has absolutely nothing to do with Troll 2. It's basically, this family moves into an apartment complex that is enchanted, I guess you could say. And there's a troll, and they're trying to re-overtake the world. But to do that, they have to, I don't know if possess isn't really the right word. They kind of, this one troll has a little green light up ring and he turns a world. Like, yeah, he basically transforms an entire apartment into this like fairyland. And then this old lady who's like centuries old witch is just like, gets befriended by the young boy who moves into town, and his sister is one of the people that get like possessed by the troll, and he's trying to save his sister. And he very frankly asks this old lady if she's a witch. And she was like, yeah, actually I am. Funny you should ask. And then they become chummy, and then they save the apartment complex, and then the family moves away, and that's pretty much it.
Wow. Bonus review content here on Film Strip. I'd love it.
All right, Jay, so cut that part out and put it on as a troll
one. Yeah, we'll put out another episode. That's another month's of content right there. We'll stretch that. When you're talking about that, Lindsay, and when you said it's like a Ghoulies ripoff, the immediate thing I think of, like my frame of reference for that has always been like Critters was the thing I saw as a kid, and I kind of was team Critters, and I just did that. And you can go back to the archives. Nick and I did the Critters movies years ago, and they're a lot of fun. And then even if you go further back and trace your way through, Brian and I put her through several years of hell doing all those Leprechaun movies, and I feel like Troll One and Ghoulies and Critters and Leprechaun kind of all live in the same like sea level trash bin of horror that I'm the kind of person that will consume, and there are movies that require absolutely nothing from you except those minutes that you will never get back, and if you're down for that, they will light them on fire gleefully with you. That's what they are. But Troll 2 is a whole nother level of things.
Before we get into really talking about Troll 2, I'm going to go ahead and pimp my product. At the top of the show, I recently interviewed Scott Grimes. You might remember as a little kid from Critters 1 and Critters 2.
Yes, yes.
It's going to be in the Den of Geek magazine. It'll be on the Den of Geek website, and it will be free for attendees of San Diego Comic-Con. So if you're in SDCC territory, or you just want to go to the Den of Geek website, check that out. It's a pretty good interview, and I cut so much good stuff out of it that I will send. I'm going to send these to later. That it's it could have been a much cooler interview, but I only had one page.
Yeah, well, and we won't tell all the different ways you had to go to get that interview. It's almost at the links that they have to go to make this movie even happen, plus the for the plot to even work. But we'll get into all of the what's of this and our impressions of it. I mean, goodness, I think the internet's had a lot of time spilt on Troll 2, but I do think our unique perspectives as aficionados of beautiful pieces of garbage here on Film Strip will make this our own twist of this. So Ron, my captain, please do tell us what happens in the magical story of Troll 2. And I've been waiting for this all day. I can't wait to hear what you come up with.
Well, Jay, I see you over there standing on the table. You want to piss on hospitality? Go somewhere else, kid, because here in Nilbog, we don't put up with that kind of big city behavior. Michael Watts and his family have moved into the country to get a little fresh air and explore farming life. Michael's got some kind of weird farming fetish. The only problem is the ghost of young Joshua's dead grandfather, Seth, keeps warning him that the people of Nilbog are not to be trusted, because they're not people. They're goblins, even though the title of the movie is Troll. For the purposes of the movie, we're just going to call them trolls, because Troll apparently made enough cash to be successful, and this movie is going to be called Troll 2, because we're trying to make some fucking lira here, people. Joshua isn't the only one in the family who's getting distracted from Michael's vision of farming Edel. His sister Holly has this weird boyfriend, Elliot, who seems to like spending time with his friends more than his girlfriend. After a punch in the balls and an ultimatum, he's making some promises. He's going to join the family in Nilbog, too. Albeit, he doesn't show up when he's supposed to. He rolls into town later in an RV with some of his dumbass friends, because why would he possibly learn a lesson after being punched in a sack? Immediately, upon rolling into Nilbog, the first thing you notice is that the whole place is weird as hell. the host family, the presents are weird children of the corn looking folks. The food and the gifts they left behind, well, if you believe the ghost of Seth, the dead grandfather, and why wouldn't you believe the ghost of your dead grandfather? It's all goblin poisons designed to turn people into half plant, half people monsters so they can be eaten. The only way to stop the family dinner is to piss off Dad and piss on the food. Thankfully, we don't see Joshua actually piss on the food. And he jumps up on the table and zips his fly, and that's close enough for me. Because we're not trying to do a Michael Jackson thing here. We're just trying to make a movie.
No, that's an R. Kelly thing. Okay, let's get it. Let's get it right, okay?
That's a good point. No, he's the wrong gender to be an R. Kelly kind of thing. Meanwhile, Elliot's dumbass and all his dumbass friends roll into Nilbog, where one of them, a sub-Eddie Deason type named Arnold, finds a girl being chased by goblins. Like, actual little ugly goblin monsters. Not just, like, you know, weird-looking people and in baggy costumes or whatever. Arnie tries to talk some sense to them, but takes a spear to his chest for his troubles. And after getting stabbed, apparently the best thing to do is to run into another strange building in town. Him and the girl who he doesn't know run into an old country church out in the woods. Turns out it's not a church. It just looks like a church because they rented a church building for 5 days. And it's the home of a woman named Credence Leonore Gielgud. Which is the worst fake name you've ever heard. In addition to that, though, she is some kind of druid witch kind of thing who is skilled in the art of overacting. Gives her guests a drink, and bang, we're in VeggieTales country. The girl, who didn't get stabbed, turns into a half-vegetable, half-person, and is promptly eaten by a bunch of goblins. Arnold, upon discovering this, screams in horror, I guess, if that's what you want to call what he does. And then he falls guilty to the same vegetable fate. Back in the city, or rather back on farming life, rather than eating piss-covered food, Michael and Joshua head into the town the next day to find new food to piss on. Turns out the only store in town is closed. Michael falls asleep, probably because of low blood sugar or bad writing, and Joshua stumbles across a goblin church sermon, which talks about the evils of eating meat. That's right, folks. These goblins are vegan, or at least vegetarian. Probably just vegetarian. They love milk. But that's not the point. The point is Joshua can't sneak around without screwing things up. He falls literally into the church service and everyone grabs him and threatens to feed him poisonous Nilbog ice cream, which kind of looks like if you mixed like styrofoam with water. Either way, Michael, despite being dumb as hell, gets there in the nick of time and gets his son to safety? Question mark. Meanwhile, Elliot's disposable friend, Drew, who's somehow even worse than Arnold, falls into the clutches of Nilbog's weirdo sheriff freak, who gives him a weird green sandwich and a big old glass of clotted, gross, yogurty-ass Nilbog milk. Obviously, if you drink bad milk, you're going to feel sick, whether it's Nilbog milk or normal milk. And a sick, stumbling Drew finds his way into town, then finds his way to Arnold, who is like half person, half tree, like some kind of like even less interesting swamp thing. Credence says, all right, it's time for the Clearwater Revival. She kills Drew, then chops Arnold into pieces. Well, presumably she kills Drew. We don't see it on screen. It's just kind of implied. The guess is that Drew ends up becoming food, which has been prepared for a surprise apology party, because that's a real thing that happens in this town. For Joshua and the gang after the weirdness at the church. Joshua tries to contact his grandfather, Seth, only to have misdialed his Ouija board, and he accidentally contacts Credence instead. She leaps through the window, tall man style, and attacks Joshua, only for Seth to appear and chop her hand off with an axe. Not in a cool, evil, dead way, but just in kind of like a weird, like boring way. Anyway, to further end the side plot of Elliot's dumbass friends, Credence goes back to her chapel, pushes her cleavage up, then finds a way to go after and kill Elliot's last friend with some very cheap popcorn that looks like they went to the local movie theater and said, oh, you're going to throw that away? And then rather than pay for it at the time, they wait till they throw it away, then they take it out of the dumpster and pour it on the board.
I'm just going to interject right now. We're going to have to discuss whether or not that sex scene is more disturbing or what we saw in Silent Night, Deadly Night 5. I just want to put that on the table.
There's nothing more disturbing than Silent Night, Deadly Night 5.
how dare I forget the nomination? Yes, please go.
How else are you going to wash down that popcorn? You got to have a nice V8. Oh, God. Meanwhile, at the party, Seth and Joshua try to stop things from progressing using a Molotov cocktail, only for the local priest to show up and banish Seth back to hell with a spell. I mean, it's kind of asking a lot for us to believe that Seth is in hell in the first place, but who am I to argue with a priest, goblin or not? You know, he's got that collar on. He's kind of speaking with authority. But before he goes, Seth himself pulls out a spell book, calls another spell out, and the priest gets struck by lightning and explodes in a big fireball. What the hell even is this movie? Michael shows up, puts the fire out, but after he does that, everyone notices, hey, that priest isn't a people, it's a goblin. But before the other goblins can attack the Waits family, they run back into the farmhouse and hole up for safety, Night of the Living Dead style. If, you know, Night of the Living Dead had even less of a budget and no good actors. The family gathers together to do a seance, and Seth comes back from the dead long enough to give Joshua a secret anti-goblin weapon. Watch out, goblins. Joshua has a bologna sandwich. And after he shovels that sumbitch into his mouth, he's now poisonous to goblins, I guess because of the power of, like, weird potted meat? Question mark. Anyway, he uses his newfound bologna fart powers to touch the Stonehenge stone, the secret of Credence's magical abilities. And upon touching it, he kills all the goblins because she's the head goblin. And if you kill her and kill her stone, you kill all the other monsters in town because we're operating under Lost Boys rules, apparently, which is a surprise to me because I wasn't expecting that. And we didn't get the grandpa to show up, like, to run over, you know, the head vampire.
Credence.
Anyway, long story short, everyone in Nilbog's dead. The family returns home, and Joshua's mother enjoys a nice hearty meal. Joke's on you, you non-character. You just ate a whole shitload of goblin poison food. Joshua walks in to find goblins gathered around his dead mother's green vegetable corpse. Joshua screams in horror, question mark, as credits roll.
Bravo. That is quite a performance to get through. So many things to go with here, but wow. I mean, we could talk about, like, if you want to know the backstory of the movie, go watch Best Worst Movie. Michael Stevenson, the kid in this, is a documentary filmmaker, and he made a movie about all of this, and it tells you everything that you ever wanted or needed to know about it. Lindsay, I'll echo you 10 out of 10 on that one. Recommend that to watch. It's on YouTube right now, I think, even too. Like, you just find it. And
yeah, I just watched it on YouTube.
Yeah, I mean, it's out there. It's fun, and you can do all that. But just to walk through this like we normally would film strip style, you asked it in the middle there, Ron, and I have this question too. What in the hell kind of movie is this even supposed to be? Because I know the woman that wrote it is Claudio Fragasso's wife, right? And she apparently, her inspiration for this were like her Hollywood, Italian Hollywood friends or whatever, who all went vegetarian and apparently really pissed her off or something. Like, that's what this whole thing is, right? Is her making a riff on vegetarians.
This is the best anti-vegetarian propaganda I have ever seen, truly. And before I knew that that was her inspiration, at the end, I thought that to myself. I was like, I think this is anti-veggie propaganda. I'm pretty sure that's what I'm watching. I'm here for it. I'm, you know, that's cool, but... Then when I saw that interview with her, she was like, yeah, a bunch of my friends went vegetarian and it pissed me off. So I made the goblins vegetarian.
It's just what an inspiration. And then for your husband to go, yes, we must. And, you know, just to make like this ridiculous farce out of it. But
it's the commentary on life.
Yes, but the framing device to be that your son has this whole sixth sense I see dead people thing going on with his grandpa is certainly a choice, and not one that I saw coming. And the first time I saw this movie, honestly, I was like, is Grandpa just like running to the bathroom a lot? Because like I didn't get that he was dead. Like I missed that line because it's not, you know, so hard to miss the incredible line readings in this movie. I
didn't realize they just yell everything.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what the line is. Grandpa Seth is dead for a long time. And I'm like, I know like they made you translate it directly from Italian to English and wouldn't let you change the words, but the inflection is your choice. And I was just blown away. But that, but I wanted to get y'all's take on the whole idea of the ghost of Grandpa past, present, and future sort of driving this whole movie as the thing that fuels Joshua and everything he does.
Man, it's so weird because he's not ghosty ghost. He's not fully ghost because he can hold things and interact in ways that I feel like you don't normally see ghosts interacting, you know, in other movies of this nature. God, it's so weird. This whole movie's so weird. I'm not even sure how to answer that question.
Well, I mean, really. You think about like the frame, what my frame of reference for that is Patrick Swayze and Ghosts, and like him and Vincent Chiavelli trying to teach him how to push a Pepsi can for 5 minutes, you know, and I'm like, man, sure. Grandpa's
holding a Molotov cocktail, like,
yeah, and an axe
and handing it to a 5-year-old.
Rocking a chair. I mean, Grandpa got the afterlife down quick, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
He's on that Beetlejuice Express plan.
Is that what that is? Okay.
Really show up and just start messing things up. I mean, yeah. You know, it's so weird that Claudio Fragasso, he's like legitimately talented as like a camera guy and a producer. He worked with like one of the sleaziest directors in the world, Joe D'Amato.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of like actually good or at least interesting weird pictures in Italy. And D'Amato is actually one of the producers of this. He was one he's who found like the money for Grasso to do Troll 2. And boy, I bet he regrets that.
I mean, yeah, they
regretted that before he died.
They scrawled together enough money to go out to Utah for like 20 days. And this is what became of it. And I don't know. I think it's such a, I realize we're going to make the kid the lead star of this because I mean, I guess once you cast the thing, you're like, well, can any of these people carry this at all? I guess the kid. And so they go with that. But I thought like for a little bit, I was like, okay, so Grandpa's going to be like in the beginning of it. He's going to pop up in the middle and he's going to say, here's how you do the ooga booga at the end and win. But Grandpa is actively a part of this plot for the entire movie. And I'd forgotten that. And I thought, man, like, do you think they bothered to explain to this actor like what he was supposed to be doing? Or did he ever go, am I dead or alive? Like, I don't know that he even knew because he doesn't play like a ghost. He plays like he's actually there. It's almost like later on when you hear him talk about it, he's like, I'm not really sure I knew I was dead. In the movie.
Well, famously, Fragasso speaks little to no English, and they had no translator on to actually talk to the actors. So the entire time, he's talking to the actors in his best broken English, while also like simultaneously referring to them as like dogs and treating them like subhumans.
So it's like a George Lucas production, is what you're saying.
Well, worse, because Fragasso could neither write that shit nor say it.
It's fair. But yeah, we have Joshua and Grandpa having their little fireside chats. And then we meet our parents. And what can you say about good old George Hardy here and Margot Prey, his wife, Michael and Diana? Does the phrase negative chemistry like come together at all?
Negative chemistry.
I mean, Lindsay, you've been in a lot of plays and things, and you've seen people cast together. You ever seen two people more worsely matched as a couple in your life?
What was that movie with Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez? Geely,
yeah. They're actually married again. So yeah, in real life. Yeah. So.
Proof that you can have romantic chemistry, but not on screen or on stage chemistry. That is a thing.
Yeah.
negative chemistry. I just, I think it's just the way they delivered every line, because they just yelled every line, even if it was a nice one. So negative chemistry is a great way to put it. George Hardy, what a delightful man.
Yeah, I mean, by all accounts, a very, very nice person. Like, everyone seems to love him. But
so entertaining. So entertaining to watch.
He's so, like, at some point he had to realize how bad he was in this. And just
he went did. With it. He knew how bad he was.
Just went with it.
But, like, he was really trying, you know.
Like, when you're earnest and bad, it's like special to that. I don't know. I thought he was funny. And until I bothered to look it up, just the first time I saw this movie, I thought the woman that played his wife and the woman that plays Credence the Witch were just the same person in makeup, because they do the same stuff. And in retrospect, I'm like, that would have been genius casting. Like, to tie it together like that.
That would have been way more interesting.
Right? She would have been, like, when we do the David Gordon Green, Danny McBride remake of Troll 2, that's what should happen. Like, we should rewrite that into existence, because that would make a lot more sense.
Yeah. I don't think you can make a remake of Troll 2. I think it just has to live in its...
I can dream.
It just needs to live in its terrible, like... delightfulness.
Speaking of living in its terrible delightfulness, can we talk about Holly, the jazzercising, boyfriend hating teenage sister from absolute hell? Her intro scene is one of the most striking things I've ever seen in a movie. It's just like, I'm watching this and going, where is she in relation to these other four people that we've met? Because they do not look like they come from the same family.
Well, the whole health commentary webbed in and out of this movie, and what we now know in, like, you know, late 80s, early 90s, pretty much into the, well, I'd say early aughts at least, this really disordered eating pattern, and how, like, this poor girl is just like working out, lifting her little bar that's clearly too light for her to lift. Like, you could see that they just gave her the lightest bar ever, and she was like, okay, whatever. Here I go. This is what they told me to do. And then her mom opens the door and looks at her just like beating herself up, you know, to be this, you know, skinny 80s goddess, and or early 90s. 1990 is basically the 80s, you know, and she just like smiles sweetly like, oh, that's my girl, and then closes the door. And I was like, oh, yeah, there's the perpetuation of disordered eating that we all know and love.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. Like, that, there's this whole subtext to that too, and then like her open hostility to the boyfriend and stuff when he's trying to sneak in her window. Like, You know the scene where Sydney and Billy have that really fun scene in Scream, where they have like a good back and forth? Yeah. Imagine that, but like really bad. And that's what you have here.
Yeah, that. Yeah,
release your needs scene in the bathroom or whatever it is she says. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah. The Scream scene is what this could have been, but wasn't even close.
No. It's amazing to watch the way she has to try to spew these lines out and run as the writer here. Like, how, I understand there's a difference in translation from Italian to English or whatever, but how at some point do you not, like, at least try to form words that would make sense to an American audience? Because the things that this woman says are not what any teenager has ever said, ever.
I think he tried to, Claudio Fragrasso and his wife tried their best, but they refused to let the actors change the lines on set, which they talk about in Best Worst Movie. And they refused to have anyone who speaks English look over their script prior to. He made them read the words that were directly on the page, whether they made sense or not. And that's,
and on one hand, that like makes sense that he feels like he's that good, but at the same time, it's like he should know as an Italian how to do a multi-language production, because in every Italian movie in the 70s and 80s, there aren't three people on the set that speak the same language at the same time. Like the crews are German, the directors Italian, the writers are Spanish, the actors are English and American and South American. They're from all over the world. Nobody speaks the same language, and somehow they figured out if Joe D'Amato and Bruno Mattei can pump out like reasonable exploitation movies, why could he not figure it out on his own set?
Yeah, it's really amazing to watch it. Even in the first 15 minutes here, and the whole setup with the vacation they're doing, it's like the Airbnb exchange from hell or something. But I got this whole, like, if you remember the very original Chevy Chase, Beverly D'Angelo Vacation, like the setup is where they get in the living room and dad like shows them the little AAA triptych with on the little dot, you know, dot, dot, dot thing. And Rusty chases it with a Pac-Man or whatever. And I just remember thinking like, this movie's trying to do that same thing where dad's really excited about the vacation and no one else cares about going to Wally World. But dad has this like farmer fetish situation. And I love the, like the Green Acres joke of that, right? Is that, well, every American in the city just wants to go live on the farm. And then that's what they go with. Was that a thing, like that you could do a home exchange with like another family at some time in life? I've never heard of that in my life, but was that like something we did in America at one time, or did we do that in Italy?
It must be. That's what the whole movie The Holiday is based on.
Oh, I did not know
Jack
that.
Black and Jude Law.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, wow.
So it's that a thing time. You can
Neil Bog time again. Come on down for Goblin Vacation.
Ron coming at you with it.
Yeah, but I did not expect to get singing around tonight too. Wow, it must be my birthday.
That is a spinoff I would watch.
I would watch Christmas Troll 2 all day. Yes, I agree.
Every Don't
day.
Give people ideas to make an actual movie about Christmas trolls, because they probably already have.
I mean, if they haven't, that's a failure in our society, and we deserve all the punishment we get for it. But no, I love this idea that this conceit that they're going to go and do this whole house exchange thing, right? And that's like, I love how the girl is pleading with the father, like, please wait on my boyfriend. He is my one true love. Like, she's reading it off a frigging Hallmark card. You know? And he's like, if he can't show up on time, he's not the boy for you. And I'm like, man, this Ozzy and Harriet in the middle of this 80s movie is just fucking hilarious, man.
And that is like the most dad thing ever. If he can't show up on time, then he's not your man.
Like, he speaks as someone who has heard these words sometime in your life.
No, not from mine. I've heard dad say shit like that.
Was he supposed to be like related to Tom Coughlin? So, like, if you're not 15 minutes early, you're late.
Yeah, something like that.
But they still waited for like an hour and a half and he didn't show up.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think
I was thinking to myself, like, no dad is waiting an hour and a half extra.
Let's be honest, though. This family, like, there was no way they had their crap together. They didn't even pack, and they're supposed to be going on vacation for a month. Like, nobody had a suitcase, nothing. So it was, yeah, they were about as ready to go as Private William T. Santiago was from Gitmo and A Few Good Men. They didn't know you're going anywhere. It's just the plot. So, but I love how Elliot shows up with his boys in his RV from I don't know, the outtakes of Prisoners or something. And he's over there with that. And you called it out in the plot summary, Ron. What is, I think there's another subtext here, because Holly does drop a slur on Elliot in there, but she may not be wrong. I think he's way more interested in his boys than he is her. I think there's something else going on there.
So there's like four of these guys, right? In a full-size RV.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
There's room enough for everyone to have their own bed in a full-size RV. You don't need to share a bed
but with your friends. Do.
Share a bed without shirts on. I'm just saying.
And the lack of pants is implied. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like there's text and then there's subtext and then it's just the text. And I think the text is there. I think that Claudio Fragasso is trying to tell us something there too.
I mean, this isn't text. This is just like straight up pictures.
Yeah. Well, worth 1,000 words or maybe worth a word at this point. But yeah, the chase of the boyfriend. And what I kept waiting for was like a side adventure of the RV, like something like The Hills Have Eyes. And we kind of get that because they're the ones that get in trouble with the Credence and everything. So it's like they do a little callback to that. And I kind of wonder if they weren't specifically referencing that as part of the trouble that they all get into, because they're not really directly responsible for any of the plot moving along. But they're also like the dead meat that you have to have in a horror movie to show you how, you know, bad the evil people are. So before we start killing the main people.
Yeah. Or dead goo, as the case may be.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Cause they're not meat. I forgot. How dare I? Yes.
Yeah. Come on. These are vegetarian. They're
goblins' favorite food, Joshua. So, yeah. Green jello, you know. It's, yes.
Yak. That's what it looked like.
I mean,
that stuff.
That, yeah. I mean, it looked like.
Slick Vaseline.
Yeah.
Like the green jelly.
Yes, it's like you when you go to the hospital and they give you a Shasta and a bowl of that, you know, get well, kid.
Yeah, drink this to prepare for your colonoscopy in the morning.
Yeah, pretty much. That's what that's all about. But no, I love how we get all of that, and then when they get to the house, like you said, the children of the corn family, you know, hands them the keys and good luck, have a great day. And there's the zombie children just go off, you know, because they're all goblins. And Grandpa, of course, is yelling at Joshua. And I love how that. They stopped time, and it was at this point that my wife walked through the room because she was actually with me while I was watching this, and she looked at it and said, are they supposed to be frozen? And I said, yeah, why? She said, because they're all moving. And so I don't know what is going on with the scene and why they. What am I trying to say? Okay, the way they, I know when you're trying to do a frozen scene, right? Like it's very expensive to do the back shot of it and actually freeze everybody. But when your actors are in like mid pose and you're asking them to hold like a corn of cob with some Aquafresh on it and they clearly can't, why do you keep zooming in on it? I mean, it's so clear.
Or, you Maybe. Know, have your actors pose in poses that they can hold for longer than, like, you know, 10 seconds without starting to twitch or itch or flinch.
I'm sure old Claudio has some excuse for it or some meaning behind it.
I know, like, you know,
It's a commentary on how we're all actually frozen in our lives, but... Not really.
No, but I will give this movie credit for this, is we have to have some intervention to stop them. Joshua, you must not let them eat it. And when you're a boy of 9, what else can you do? Either grab the Red Ryder BB pistol or drop trow and go to town, right? And what an artistic choice to just have him piss all over hospitality.
It's a real this is my rifle, this is my gun choice. So, that he made.
I mean, Arlie Ermey would be proud. But, yeah, I mean, I just thought at this point, I mean, if you didn't already know, like at this point, I was just like, this movie is so bonkers, and we're not even 30 minutes in. What the hell is happening here? And when he's running through the house with the kid and he's throwing him on the bed and he thinks he's just going to, you know, whip him or whatever. And he just tightens his belt up so he doesn't feel hunger pains or whatever. I just had flashbacks to that MRI room in After Last Season, Ron, that was like in somebody's basement. It was clearly just somebody's house. And there's like, yeah. Do we need to like move anything out of the way? Nah, just leave the way it is. You know, it's like, let's see if we just came over and shot down your hallway for a minute.
We just put a piece of paper up on your door that says MRI that we clearly printed off of like a dot matrix printer from 1987.
Yeah. but it's the moment when like you think you're about to see child abuse and then you don't. It's like, what are you gonna do to me, daddy? I'm going to tighten my belt so I don't feel hungry, you little brr, brr, brr. And I don't know, I just was sitting there just laughing my ass off at this point, because I'm like, this movie is so bonkers, and how can you not just love it? It's, yes, it's entirely terrible, but it's totally hilarious at that point, right?
It's so great. I love the interview with Claudio when he's watching people watch his movie, this movie. And he's like, they laughed at stuff that's not supposed to be funny. And they laughed at stuff that is supposed to be funny. They laughed through the whole movie. And I was like, yeah, dude. Yeah, they did.
I think he's the only person that didn't get his joke. Because everyone else clearly did.
Yeah.
At some point along the way.
Yeah.
He's like if Tommy Wiseau didn't lean into the comedy and tried to fight back that he was a legitimate filmmaker.
And not just some weird leather vampire.
And it's so weird because, like, Claudio Fragrasso, if he'd paid any attention to any of the people he'd worked with, he could have done something better than this.
But would it have been better? Here's the thing I want to ask you. As goofy as this movie is, if it had started like trying to be serious all of a sudden, I don't think it would have worked. I think the fact that it just continued to be goofy the whole way through, and I don't care what the actors say. I think they all knew that this was horrible. So they just did it as goofy as they could and as big as they all could. And it's what gives the movie charm. Because if they tried to play this like really straight, like seriously, there's no way it would have played. There's no way it would have played.
You know what the most unfortunate thing is for these actors is that most actors aren't in starring roles when they're still figuring out how to act. So there is no film evidence of their bad acting. You know, because you continue to work on it and mm-hmm. you get better. Everything you get cast in, you hopefully, you know, get a little bit better and learn a little bit more. And these actors had the unfortunate, you know, luck to get cast as leads in the best, worst movie ever made. And because of that, a lot of them were not cast in other things that they auditioned for, because people were like, oh no, no, we saw that one. No, no. You know, there's a video record of their bad acting. I don't know if your parents ever filmed you doing stuff when you were kids, like your little church Christmas plays or whatever you did. Mine did. And every now and then I remember being home and my mom was like, oh, I have this video from when you were in this musical. Let's put it in. And I'm like, no, 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 please don't. Please
that,
don't.
That, thankfully, when I was younger, video cameras were not around, but I have a pretty good video record of all the times I tried to be a rock and roll or a country star, and thank God VHS doesn't translate much these days. Ron's wife's one of the few. Ron's wife's one of the few people that's actually seen the disaster live a couple of times, so she lived to tell about it too. But speaking of live to tell, we got to talk about Credence Leonore Gielgud. Maybe the
what a name.
Yeah, what a name, but what a fucking performance, man.
Yeah.
I mean, just it is out of this world watching this woman just chew scenery that's not there.
Oh, man. What did you say in your plot summary, Ron? She definitely gets the overacting award for sure. Just, but like, I could just eat it all up.
Right. Yeah.
Did she do her own makeup? It was unclear, but she was on makeup. I saw for the movie Dumb and Dumber. She was on the makeup crew. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, because her makeup was hands down like way more professional than anybody else's.
Yeah, next to the tree boy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I cannot confirm, but I feel like she did her own makeup and blood and all that stuff. Either way, if she didn't, the makeup artist really liked her because she
clearly she got all the attention in the makeup department, that's for sure. And it goes through too, but her whole thing, and it didn't hit me, Ron, until you were talking about it in the plot summary, that this is all like a Stonehenge riff. So in some cinematic universe, this is tied to Connell Cochran and fucking mm-hmm. Halloween 3. You know, like they're like cousins or something. He murdered all the children in Santa Mira with the mask, and then she got Nelbog in Utah. You know, and that's
we got to work in like Santa Carla.
Yeah, so somewhere that all came through. Yeah, but I could say that Michael is probably one of Grandpa's, like, you know, nephews or something. Like, I could go with that. Right? We could buy that. Or Grandpa was this officer's grandpa was maybe that grandpa's, like, brother, second cousin, twice removed or something. Like, you could buy that. Grandpa could be there for him. But I know Credence is so amazing every time she's on the screen and everything she does. And what's even more amazing is that when they, you know, usually in a cheap horror movie, like, you want to hide the mask and stuff, like, no, like, we're going to get full daylight shots of the plastic ass from the Dollar Tree Halloween goblin mask. Not glued down, like, it's clearly hanging loose. I just cracked the whole time watching it, going, man, like your movie's called Goblins. You clearly want to make it about goblins, and you don't have a lot of money. The thing in the horror movie, when you don't have a lot of money, is the one thing you spend money on is the effects, right? Like Friday the 13th, the original one, the only thing they spent any money on was the fucking blood. And
Silent Night, Deadly Night 5.
Right. Yeah. You spend money on the effects, and they could, the effects of this are so bad. Oh, it's so bad.
So I mentioned at the beginning how my cousins and I, like, giggled through the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that we thought was the most hilarious was every time the goblins showed up on screen with their masks.
Right.
It just killed, man. We could not stop laughing. That was that. And that is the thing that stuck with me all through these years. It's been at least a decade since I've seen this movie. And the one thing I remember was how bad the goblin costumes were.
Oh, yeah. They're like little, like, sort of small druid priests or something, or, you know, dressed like Jawas almost. Again, the cheapest, like, goblin mask you can,
like, paper mache.
Mm-hmm, yeah, with the big blue eye
thing going on. Yeah.
And just so ridiculous. And, like, they gave him a noise too. I don't know if you caught it. It was like this little,
yeah.
And I'm like, who bothered to, like, record that in the background? Somewhere someone did. But I was blown away at the goblins in general.
So, like,
just their whole thing.
I went to look up who did most of the makeup, and it's Italian guy Maurizio Trani, who was the makeup artist on the Oscar nominated Cinema Paradiso. Among what? Other things, like, so he'd been nominated for an Oscar. He did a bunch of, like, legit, like, if you've ever seen any of, like, Lucio Fulci's movies from the 80s, like New York Ripper or Manhattan Baby or House by the Cemetery, famously starring everyone's least favorite child, Bob, The Beyond, Zombie. He did the makeup for all of those movies. So, like,
man, well, wow. He really liked Deborah Reed.
Yeah, a lot.
I could see that, because she was the only one who seemed like she, like, everyone seemed to try hard, but she was the only one who seemed to, like, realize that this movie was what this movie was supposed to be and what it ended up being, which is funny because the only person on the set who spoke English was the costume designer, who is an actress named Laura Gimser, who played Emmanuel in a couple movies. She was in a bunch of Joe D'Amato stuff in the 70s. Mm-hmm. She played Emmanuel a lot before she got too old to be Emmanuel. She was in, like, Ator the Flying Eagle, the Fighting Eagle, and those H horror movies.
So what you're saying is that there are a lot of people with genre cred in this, and even though they don't have any money, somehow they still screwed it up, which is amazing.
Yeah, a lot of people who were used to like doing things with no money, like somehow found themselves having less money. And literally, the only reason this movie has the masks that they do is because Joe D'Amato owned the masks from some sort of goblin movie that he bought.
Recycled, even.
Yeah, we'll just use these masks. And because the original title of the original movie was supposed to be called Goblins.
Right. It was
supposed to be like a family friendly horror movie, which is why they're all turning people into vegetables and eating vegetables. Because like kids are supposed to be like, ew, vegetables, and not like, oh, weird. That's monsters. Amazing.
Yeah, but that's before like mom is topless and covered in green jelly and we're eating her.
I mean, they added that back in, I think. I'm pretty sure that got added in at a certain point when they're like,
oh, this movie did not have reshoots, man. That was in there somewhere.
So,
there's no callback for like no test audience.
They shot that scene for the Italian market where family friendly has a much different meaning.
That is also probably true. Very, very fair. Speaking of which, too, like just finding things. The guy that they have working the general store literally had walked out of the hospital and they're like, well, the other guy didn't show up. You want to do this? And he said,
mental hospital.
Yeah. He's like, I had no idea where I was. I was not in a good place in life. And I was like, it shows.
He was great.
Probably
the best actor in that entire film.
Yeah. You want somebody to be really sinister. All we have is milk here in Nilbog. And it's like, you know, room temperature milk. And I'm already just in suspicious land anyway, because milk is like I've never been a person that just drank milk for what it was, like on things, in things, fine. But the consistency situation for me has always been a problem. I've had to get the calcium elsewise. Ron, I see you're agreeing with me on this because, I just can't do it. And when they go into this whole milk thing, it is maybe the grossest thing in the movie to me. Like, I just, like buttermilk, I can't do it. It's a generation lost on me. I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so glad. I am so glad that you said that, Jay, because one of the first times I'm also in that camp. I never just really drank milk. I'll eat it on, I'll put it on cereal or whatever. I'll drink it in ways that are normal, but I don't just want to drink it with dinner. That seems inherently weird to me and unnatural. Yeah. And one of the first times I was ever at like Brian's apartment when we were just dating, he took milk out and drank it out of the fridge. And I looked at him horrified and I said, are you just gonna drink milk? Like, absolutely disgusted. And to this day, he still thinks it's one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Because he's like, yeah, what do other people do? I'm like, why are you drinking milk?
Yeah.
But because I just didn't until like, but he comes from a very like milk that he comes from a milk family. They all like drink milk with dinner and that's mine didn't. So it was just so weird to me.
Did he grow up on a dairy farm or something? Is there like
no, but that's
reason?
The thing. Like I grew up cows, like on a farm and we didn't, I mean, I guess my dad and my brothers, I don't know. I wasn't, but he does. So when we drank milk, we used to have to shake it because it was from the farm. So it's just like so ingrained in my head that I have to shake the milk before I drink. It doesn't matter what kind of milk it is or where it came from. I have to shake it before I pour it on anything, which I had to explain to him too. But we just didn't drink milk with dinner. That wasn't a thing that we did. But
that just makes me think of the punchline to a joke I don't remember, but it's pasteurized? No, just about up to her tits.
Oh, speaking of which,
the green goo, yeah, all over her tits.
The only thing in this that like the next bit that I have to say, like I always felt like the thing that the Children of the Corn really screwed up in all of its iterations was trying to do the religious ceremonies of the children and the He Who Walks Behind the Rose and all that kind of stuff. And just that they just sort of over sensationalized like what country intense church is all about or whatever. And I thought I had seen that until I saw this movie again. And I realized, man, the like town assembly slash sermons in Nilbog are hardcore. And that's when you, if you know the backstory again, that this is sort of a riff on all my, you know, pseudo new vegetarian friends. And I'm going to riff on them, you know, rip on them here a little bit. This seems like the kinds of things that this poor woman's friends like would say to her. And she just wrote them all down and put them in one speech. Like, just do it like intensely though, like you're really mad about the fact that meat exists, and this guy is just on this whole screed. And I think that guy clearly knew what movie he was into. It was hilarious.
So my question is, like, these people seem like they would otherwise be snake handlers. So, like, what meat are they passing around at their church to prove that they're holy enough to, like, withstand the temptation of beef? Are they? Did they have, like, fillets? Do they have, like, one of those ropes of sausages?
Oh, like, no.
Italian window?
I think they're holding up the can of Spam and just going, like, resist the Spam.
They're passing around, like, just individual Vienna sausages.
Yes, yeah, little Smokies, you know, they'll do that.
There's a can of Spam in my fridge right now.
It's the whole bag of, like, little Smokies with the barbecue sauce on them.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So you throw wrapped in the crescent roll.
Oh, no, the best is you put the barbecue sauce and the little Smokies in the slow cooker, throw in just a little bit of grape jelly. It's just the right sweetener. So, anyways.
For you listeners out there, none of us are vegetarian.
As if you couldn't tell. So, but
the only good vegetable has been rolled in bacon and deep fried.
I don't necessarily, the views of Ron do not represent the views of the entire film strip, the LLC.
No, I do like salad.
I like my veggies too. I like my greens. I need my green beans. Yeah, so,
green goo is fine if you top it with bacon or something. It's okay. You know,
I'm an equal opportunity eater.
I mean, look, the food is good. That is my mantra in life. I run because I want to eat things. So that's what I say to that statement. But I love how we can conjure grandpa though for like psychic power moments here or whatever, and he does cause like lightning from God or something, or I don't know, maybe the Cattlemen's Association to come down and strike the preacher. But when he burns up, he's like the Jawa on fire at the end of Star Wars. And but people are still questioning whether Joshua is telling the truth or not in his family at this point. Like, Michael's still not sure. Like, I don't know, boy's got an active imagination.
Yeah, Grandpa Seth shows up and he's like, "Hey, preacher man, Stakem sends their regards," and then he gets hit by lightning.
Yes, it is quite a moment when that happens. We kind of skipped over the guys here and how they're all getting killed off. You know, the one kid that gets stabbed with the spear, and the other kid that gets planted like he's a tree, you know, and Credence is having this whole, like, it's almost like a seance, or she's preparing to be food, but there's also like this real sexual undertone with it, like the way she's talking about it. I was like, this is getting like, we're getting freaky and weird now. All of a sudden, Leonora got different lines than everybody else, like, or she just read them different.
I feel like, and Lindsay, you might be able to back me up on this, I feel like she's in a completely separate movie and it just kind of like smashed her in with the rest of it because they had like 15 minutes of her like vamping around and showing her cleavage, and they're like, "Oh, we can't just, we're Italian, we can't just leave this on the cutting room floor."
Was she supposed to be like the Elvira introduction pieces to this thing when it was on television and they just stuck her in the movie?
Yeah,
that would have worked.
They wanted her to be like vampire-esque, but instead of drinking blood, she ate corn, I guess.
Yep, she's a regular corn star.
Oh, there it is. Well, yeah, we got to go right into it now. The corn star in the RV, man. that is what I mean. What's funny is that somehow they had enough film to do takes where the two actors aren't completely laughing their asses off at each other while they're making out over a corn of cob while popcorn is blowing around them with a hairdryer. It is a scene. I mean, it really is, y'all. Like,
I can't
yeah.
I can't not laugh thinking about it.
It's one of the best scenes in movie history. That's literally right up there with the V8.
I mean, that goes in there with the V8, with the all the toys that decided to get involved on the two you are making out in Silent Night, Deadly Night 5. It's yeah, it's right there with horror movie sex scene weirdom. Like it's right up there with all of it.
Pretty much everything from the Killer Snowman movie, Jack Frost.
Oh God!
Oh man,
Jack Frost. Yeah,
have all we of done that one. We need to add that to the list.
Yeah, that's in the archives. Brian, that many moons ago.
You know what? I'll tell you exactly what it reminds me of. Did you guys ever watch Friends? Like the show Friends? There mm-hmm. is an episode where Rachel is trying to teach Monica when they're like in high school how to be sexy. And Rachel takes this dish towel and she's like, you just take, you know, like a dish towel, like, ooh, this towel is so soft against my skin. And when Monica is trying to recreate that for Chandler, she takes like a carrot and a knife and she's like, ooh.
Yes.
And that is basically what this scene is. It's Monica from Friends trying to be sexy, but with better cleavage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing that she kills him with sex and popcorn. And this is after, we should say, she's done like the lady at the McDonald's.
I mean, there are worse ways to die.
There are, but this is after she's done like the ladies at the McDonald's drive through and come into her ultimate form and come through the mirror as a goblin and somehow had her hand chopped off by a ghost as a ghost axe. I guess I don't know how that, like, there's no explaining any of this shit, but how the hell did that even happen?
after their big hit, Marcy Playground tried lots of things to recapture that magic, but sex and popcorn was not the answer.
It was not the sequel to The Great Sex and Candy. No, sir. Wow. That was also a reference I did not think we'd be making today on the show, Marcy's Playground.
Imagine, I smell sex and popcorn.
Just imagine the smell of that RV after they were done shooting that popcorn. Just imagine the
smelled so good.
It probably improved it. Let's be honest, that RV was definitely not like a set RV. That was a used piece of equipment. Yeah. Oh man. But I love that this family, this good, wholesome American family, when all else fails, just hold a fucking seance. You know, and let's conjure the spirit of Grandpa Seth to come back one time and tell us that the secret of everything is you gotta unpurify yourself for them. And the answer to that is to eat a friggin' bologna sandwich.
Double-decker bologna sandwich.
Yes. On some serious Wonder Bread.
Oh, man. I bet there was like Kraft American cheese on that, too.
Some good. I mean, it wasn't even like Hellman's. Like, they probably got like Miracle Whip.
Miracle Whip. Yeah. I was just thinking, that's a Miracle Whip sandwich.
You gotta slap some Miracle Whip on that.
I mean,
some Hunt's ketchup.
Gross. Yeah, and... Yeah.
Too. Well, a bologna sandwich. Okay.
I mean, maybe I could go mustard, ketchup, and the mayonnaise. I don't. But I mean, that's just Thousand Island.
This sandwich is probably made by the Italian side of this film.
Okay.
And they don't really know what goes on a bologna sandwich. They're like,
that's fair.
Maybe so one of the American actors said, "I'll take care of the kid's sandwich." So maybe one of them.
They kept bringing in like mortadella on like a hoagie, like a. Like a nice Italian loaf with some olive tapenade on top, and they were just
That's not how American children eat. Have you ever been to a school? Is what they would say.
No, we don't give our 8-year-old child actor a glass of wine to wash down his mortadella.
Yeah,
I think they tried really hard to understand like Americans and the American way of life, and this movie is their homage to how they see American life, with mm-hmm. the snake churches and the bologna sandwiches
and the goofy ineffectual parents and this overly sexualized teenagers and who are latent homosexuals and all that stuff. Yeah. All of it's there. So, but I mean, it wouldn't be a good horror movie without a twist and ending, right? Go back home. And the goblins have thought enough ahead to go, you know, we did send spies to their house. So just in case these people somehow get out of this whole town alive and burn us all to death, leave some food for them there that isn't covered in aqua fresh so that they'll turn into goo anyway.
It's like green ketchup. Do you remember green ketchup?
Yes. Yeah. That dyed ketchup situation. Yeah. Yeah. So what did y'all think of the ending though? Like where mom becomes the feast. And it, I mean, it's lingeringly gross. Like they spent some time on that.
Yeah.
They had like two set pieces that were effective and gross, and it was the death of the nameless girl who finds not Eddie Deason, and then the mother. I feel like they had like the same kind of female body sized chest appliances, and they're like, well, we got to make use of this thing. We can't just show it once. We spent all this money. We spent like $50 on this thing. And we tried to stick it on the dentist, but he's way too broad. So I guess we have to stick it to the wife.
What they want.
They won't let us kill the kid, so we got to kill the wife.
Yes, yes. Got to kill, got to commit the murders on somebody. So, but then Michael's horrific the scream at the end, the leaving you hanging, or is he like accepted his fate? Was that bologna sandwich tarnished in some way? You got me thinking, Ron. I'm wondering if they're trying to say that he was like going, yes, finally dinner.
Tarnished, possibly. Room temperature, definitely.
Fair. What about you, Lindsay? What do you think? Is he horrified or is he excited at the end? Because the face plays it both ways, honestly.
I hadn't even thought about that. I read it as that he was horrified. How I read it.
One corner of the internet, I read that two of the goblins, there's supposed to be something on their garb that lets you know that they are Dad and Holly, that like they have become goblins too, and that they're part of what is eating on mom.
Really?
It's supposed to be part of the thing is that they've become somehow, and now they're feeding on mom too. That's part of the horror.
Yeah, but that's the thing is, in no part of this movie did we see someone become a goblin.
No, we saw somebody become a tree though. So
yeah,
maybe it
could now be. In Troll 1, there is at least one person who is reborn into a troll. So maybe. Mm-hmm. You know, if we want to try to find some connective tissue there, we could make that jump. But yeah,
I'm going to chalk this up to the people that do like psychologically, you know, break down Jason Voorhees from Part 6, you know, and stuff like that. Like I'm as guilty of that as anybody. How long we've been doing this show? I mean, I'm there and I think it's fun, but I had never thought of that before. But then when I read that and I watched it, I was like, you know, I can kind of, if they're going for that, like I could kind of see it. And honestly, it would be a genius idea. I mean, if everything's going to go to hell, it's got to be the Invasion of the Body Snatchers ending where it's like, you're next, you know, and he's the only one left. Right.
No, I'm happy to jump on that crazy train and do all that speculation. I hadn't heard that, but I love it. So
if only one of the goblins had been like tightening his belt, we would have known it was.
Oh yeah,
that should have been.
And the other goblin was like lifting a small plateless like bar,
or had frizzy like you know hair or something. Yes, we needed
punching a third goblin in the balls.
Well, at that point, he had been popcorned to death, so I mean it was over. So. But yeah, just so many things, and we could go on all night about it. But I think it's time to do final thoughts, recommendations, and popcorn ratings. Wow, that has a whole new meaning now as we talk about this movie.
Do you rate this movie small, medium, large, extra large, or death by?
Exactly. So Ron,
I like adding.
Oh, clearly this is a death by. No. From the purposes of watching it as a successful movie, this is obviously a non-popcorn, it's an empty box. it's pissed on Nilbog food, but for the purposes of just watching it, enjoying it as a weird, very funny train wreck, this is an extra large popcorn. I have a blast with this every time I watch it. Pretty much every time I watch it, someone will join in and watch it with me, whether it's you guys or Holly or whoever. I've never watched this movie alone because people see what I'm watching. They sit down and they're like, oh, yeah, I heard about this. This movie's supposed to be crazy and terrible. Or they show up and there's like the fake Eddie Deason like screaming with a fly buzzing around on his forehead. And they're like, are you serious? They left that. They didn't shoot around. They didn't do a read. No, they left it in the movie. They had their one shot and they took it and then they moved on in classic no budget movie style. They just did not stop to fix anything, correct anything, reread the script, coach the actors, nothing. And that's what makes this movie an extra large popcorn. Like, I love things like The Room because The Room gives you like a psychological portrait of writer, director, producer, superstar Tommy Wiseau in a very unfiltered sort of way. And this gives you absolutely nothing about Claudio Fragrasso, but it also tells you everything you need to know about what he thinks about you.
Yes.
Audience. And that is like, I have never seen someone with such contempt for the people for the actors he's working with, for the crew, for the audience, for anybody other than himself and possibly his wife. And even there's a little contempt there. But, yeah. So extra large popcorn. This movie is amazing. Just try not to die in a stank filled RV shirtless next to your friend.
Okay. Lindsay, follow that.
I don't think I can follow that. sometimes when we have these conversations, by the end of the podcast, I have changed my popcorn rating, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse, but I will not change my popcorn rating. When we started this, before we got on this podcast weeks ago, I was asked what my popcorn rating would be. And I said, oh, extra large, no question. No hesitation. And I think I cannot describe or explain the phenomenon that is Troll 2. I can't, but I'm with Ron. If anyone wants to watch it, I'll watch it with them. And I will always watch again. I don't know. There's just something it's just so weird and I love it. So it's an extra large popcorn for me. I can't explain it. That's just what it is. I love it. And I always will.
You know, we've reviewed a lot of quote bad things through the years on this show. Kindred, The Room, as you mentioned, after last season, you know, Friday the 13th part. You know, five. There's a lot of them. You know, Freddy's Dead. There's a bunch of really bad movies out there. Some with more budget, some with less. You know, some with that were clearly a Ponzi scheme after last season, and maybe this one was too. I don't know. But the thing about all of those bad movies is like they're really only consumable with other people. Like they're a lot more fun, and this one is the same way. But it's actually like an enjoyable experience to watch. Like sometimes when you watch a bad movie and you know it's bad, you're just sort of suffering for it and with it, and you just want other people to suffer with. Like my whole reason to even know about After Last Season is just to have other people suffer through it with me. It's why I made Ron and Brian do it with me all those years ago, because I just had to have other people know what that 90 minutes of hell was. And this movie though is like a enjoyable version of that. It's like, we're going to go to the fair and we're going to eat a lot of cotton candy and you're going to feel like real shit tomorrow for it, but it's going to be a good time. So,
you know, and the cotton candy will be green.
Yes, it will. And you will the next day, like you're going to go, Jay, I'm supposed to run a 5K. What are you doing to me? It doesn't matter. It's a just blow the race. And who cares? You know, it's you pay $30 for a banana. Get over it. I mean, just it is that kind of a moment. And the thing about this movie is it never fails to make me just absolutely smile because of all of its wackiness, because of all of its complete missteps, because of all, again, like you said, Ron, the contempt the director clearly has for America and everybody in the world that's associated with this. He hates it that we all love it like this. But the fact that the two real stars of it, the kid and that George Hardy, Michael Stevenson and George Hardy, have a very good, healthy sense of humor about what this was and what this did to their lives and careers, and that they just sort of lean into it and have fun with the joke. It makes me believe what I've said before is that at some point, all of the actors banded together and said, he's never going to listen. There's nothing we can do. So let's just have fun. Let's just be goofy. And Deborah walks in and said, of course, children. And just her whole thing makes this movie just amazing. And it is one of the most fun, goofy, stupid things you could ever see. So I'm going to say it too. It's freaking extra large popcorn. And I know what I've given things to before. And people are like, I can't believe you're right. Yeah, you know what? I'd watch this one again, though, because it's thoroughly entertaining. Even as bad as it is thoroughly entertaining. And it's goofy as all get out. And there's no way to ever touch it and get near it again, but I'm glad we finally got it off the list and talked about it here. Cause I mean, there's a lot of movies we could do for summer vacation, but I mean, can there be a worse Airbnb than this? I mean, there's no way. So, can you just imagine the Yelp reviews of this?
Went here for a cleansing retreat. Their green juice is excellent. Highly recommend.
Signed, Gwyneth Paltrow.
Yes. Candle available soon. Oh, in the sequel, the remake of Control 2, Gwyneth has to play Credence. That's it. I will accept no less. Oh, that would be amazing. Well, speaking of more amazing things, folks, you can follow this show's social media at Filmstrip Pod on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Starlink, wherever else you can find social media. We're probably there. You'll find announcements about upcoming shows, a link to our Letterboxd page, which eventually will have a curated list of all of our reviews. They're all up there now. They're just not in an exact order, but go to filmstrippodcast.com. That takes you to the Spotify distribution site where we're on Spotify, Apple, Google, all the places you can find the show. I mean, we've been out there forever. We have a huge back catalog. If this isn't your cup of tea, we've got serious movies. We got deep drama. We got like Orson Welles in there. We've got some, you know, 80s nostalgia. We got all kinds of slasher movies. We got some rom-coms, whatever you need. We got it for you here at Alice's Restaurant and Filmstrip. So, you know, give us a spin, share the show on your social media, leave us a positive review, helps other people find the podcast. Ron, you already dropped it one place, but tell people what you got going on at Den of Geek this summer, how they can keep up with all the cool stuff you're writing about.
Yeah. Denofgeek.com. I'm doing reviews for the new Walking Dead spinoff, Dead City, the one starring Negan and Maggie in beautiful Paterson, New Jersey, pretending to be New York, New York. I just did a feature on the Arnold Schwarzenegger Netflix show FUBAR and a genre I like to call dadcore TV. And I'll also have some features about Dead City coming along the way and probably some other fun stuff. So yeah, denofgeek.com. That's me.
Yes, follow Ron as well. We appreciate the support. So until next time, for Lindsay and Ron, I'm Jay. Thanks for listening to Filmstrip.
Thank you for listening to Filmstrip. You can find more episodes on our website, filmstrippodcast.com. The Filmstrip theme music is produced and performed by Frozen Lake 121. All content used or discussed in these podcast episodes is the property of the respective owners and used under the Fair Use Act, Section 504, C2, Title 17.